Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
According to the U.S. Department of Energy, transportation accounts for about two-thirds of the United States oil consumption and one-third of the nation's greenhouse gas emissions. As with the green buildings movement, the emerging clean vehicles movement is bringing together players from across all sectors, industry, government, and citizens, with a goal of reducing the use of polluting fuels by cars and trucks.
Alternative fuels and new types of propulsion systems, including battery electrics, are among the solutions being pursued to help reduce the country's greenhouse gas emissions as well as our dependence on petroleum fuels. To discuss the important topic of alternative fuels, we have with us Patrick Davis, who's director of the Vehicle Technologies Program at the U.S. Department of Energy. Patrick, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First, could you tell us something about the role of the Vehicle Technologies Program in advancing alternative fuels and vehicle systems?
And so the Vehicle Technologies Program is primarily an R&D program focused on reducing petroleum dependency and greenhouse gas emissions. And to meet that goal, obviously, we have to work on a lot of technologies that are alt-fuel related. So we work on everything from fuels technologies to electrification of vehicles, projects directly related to alt fuels, in addition to other technologies such as vehicle lightweighting, which really help all vehicle technologies be more efficient. But you may also be interested in that part of our program that is deployment focused, and that's our Clean Cities program. Because the Clean Cities program, which is nearing its 20th anniversary, has been focused on the deployment of alt fuel vehicle and infrastructure technologies for its entire life, so coming up on 20 years.
What are the major alternatives in fuels or other means of reducing petroleum use that are being developed in the United States right now?
Well, the ones that are specifically alt-fuel would include biofuel technologies, most notably ethanol, because just from sheer volume, it's the number one alt-fuel in use today. But a number of other biofuels are coming on very strong right now. You know probably about the push in the area of electric drive. And so electricity is an excellent alt-fuel for vehicles, not only because electric drive systems are so efficient, but of course you directly supplant petroleum there. And other technologies such as natural gas, with the great increase in natural gas reserves discovered in the last decade, natural gas is being looked at a lot more closely. And then there's other technologies, perhaps a little farther out, but are very promising, including hydrogen.
Are these fuels compatible with conventional internal combustion engines, or are there substantially different engines required to use them?
Well, there's no doubt that you could... Given almost any fuel, you could design an engine to use that fuel. But I think you're asking really about backward compatibility. And that is a significant issue because, today's engines are really quite efficient. They achieve very low emissions. And they do this in part because of their very specific designs, emission control systems, and overall control systems that are very fuel specific. So if you were to take an engine that was designed very specifically for a fuel and change the fuel, you can run into issues. So there is a issue with backward compatibility, and an example of that is our recent look at the intermediate blends of ethanol, where we did a very large test program looking at the backward compatibility of E15 into products that were really designed to run on E10.
So E15 is what, 15% ethanol fuel?
Correct, yeah.
You mentioned natural gas, and people are talking a lot about availability and the price advantages of natural gas. But for vehicle technology, what's the energy path? Are you looking at direct use of natural gas as a fuel, or using natural gas to produce some other fuels, perhaps a liquid fuel?
Well, Well, there are really a number of options being looked at. Obviously, you can use natural gas directly in an engine, so people are looking at CNG options. There's really only one light-duty vehicle for sale by an OEM right now. That's the Honda Civic running on CNG. But CNG is fairly widely used in medium-duty truck applications, including refuse vehicles and delivery trucks. Then obviously you could use CNG or use natural gas in LNG, liquefied natural gas. So really people are looking at a number of options. And finally, you can make other fuels from natural gas, as you mentioned, and you can do that in a couple different ways. One way would be what they call gas to liquids pathway, where you take natural gas and you make other fuels out of it. And this technology has really been around a long time. You can make almost any fuel that exists from natural gas. I mean, you can essentially make gasoline-like fuels. You can make diesel from natural gas. You could you pay a price for that in efficiency and cost, but it can be done. And then finally, our folks in the fuel cell program look at using natural gas to make hydrogen.
So I just want to go back and clarify. So CNG is compressed natural gas, is that correct?
Yes.
And so it's used in a gaseous form, and LNG is liquefied natural gas. So I would expect you to have different distribution and containment challenges on the vehicle because the pressures are substantially higher, I believe, for LNG.
Sure. CNG typically today is used in 3,000 PSI tanks. And and LNG, ultimately is used in the gaseous form, but it's stored mm-hmm. as a liquid, and it's a cryogenic fluid, so it's very cold and has to be kept that way. So storage, dispensing, and storage of those fuels is really quite different, and you can have both natural gas and LNG at a station, you're doing some work and planning to do so.
So as you look at the landscape of alternatives, what fuels and propulsion systems do you think we're likely to see first as major players in the marketplace?
Well, I guess obviously right now you see a lot of biofuels. Right now we use quite a bit of ethanol. E10 is most gasoline sold today is E10, so about 10% of the gasoline sold is really ethanol. So ethanol is very big, but you see other fuels coming on strongly, and you see vehicles coming out that are increasingly electrified. So plug-in hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles are plugging into the grid and are very near-term options. And as we already talked about, natural gas is starting to come on a little strong. So we really have a number of emerging alternative fuels that are being implemented.
And is the primary benefit of having fuels that are partially ethanol that portion is something that's domestically produced rather than being based from oil, or is there also an emissions reduction benefit to the proportion that's ethanol?
Well, our primary motivation for alternative fuels, no matter which one you're talking about, is really easing petroleum dependency, reducing petroleum dependency, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. When you talk about whether there's an emission benefit, I think you're probably referring to criteria pollutants. And the difference, very little difference between gasoline and E10 when it comes to criteria pollutants. And nothing of anything to note, really.
So the substantial benefit there is to the extent that it reduces petroleum dependence.
Correct.
Dependence on imported petroleum in particular, right?
Yeah, well, we're interested in, petroleum is a fungible product, so it's hard to tell when you're supplanting if you're supplanting what would have been imported or not. But the conventional wisdom says, yeah, you're supplanting imported petroleum, and we are spending over $1 billion every day in the U.S. just for the imported petroleum that we use. And so this is a major economic impact. And so easing our dependency on petroleum, imported petroleum, is very important.
So we were talking about electric vehicles. Does the vehicle technology program look at the end-to-end energy production and use? So do you think about how electricity is produced? Because a fair amount of electricity in the United States is produced with coal, and I think that's a pollution issue that people raise sometimes.
Sure. We do a lot of analysis, and that analysis, when you talk about end-to-end, we call that well-to-wheel. Some people take it even a little further and go cradle-to-grave. But most of our work has been, most of our analysis work has been well to wheel. So we look at all the emissions, and we call well to wheels because it's from, you know, the original analysis that was from the oil well to the wheels of the car, right? But in the case of electric drive vehicles, you're looking at, you know, from the original source of that electricity and the fuel that you make the electricity from to the wheels of the car. And so, yes, we're very interested in that. And, of course, EVs are very efficient. They directly supplant petroleum. But when you look at greenhouse gas emissions, we normally look at what we call the grid mix. Obviously, you could pick some place in the country which is very heavily dependent on coal, and you'd get one set of numbers versus, say, some location that has a high percentage of renewables. So we tend to look at the country as a whole. And we have we have data on what that grid mix is and what the emissions from it are. And so when you look at electric drive vehicles, there are greenhouse gas emissions benefits when you compare it to the well-to-wheels emissions from the grid mix. But ultimately, as a nation, we do need to improve the greenhouse gas signature of our power generation. And this is really in pretty good agreement with EVs and the time frame it will take to turn over the vehicle fleet to incorporate more electric drive.
How long do you think it'll take before we see substantial market penetration of alternative fuel?
That is a extremely difficult question to answer for a number of reasons. One, you know, there are just so many alt fuels. And then, you know, you're really trying to predict the market. And so in one sense, you would say this could happen pretty quickly. We have a petroleum dependency issue. Most people would agree that the cost of petroleum over time is going to go up, not down. And so we have incentive to move away from petroleum. On the other hand, hybrid vehicles have been on the market for over 10 years. And today they're only about 3% of sales. So while we are very optimistic that these alt fuel technologies can become a significant portion of our vehicle sales, especially in light of corporate average fuel economy standards that have been increased, it's very difficult to put a time frame on it. I will tell you this. Most new technologies in the automotive industry take about 15 to 20 years to sort of achieve their maximum market share, to sort of take over the market. This is true whether you're talking about front-wheel drive or port fuel injected or any number of other vehicle technologies. And then at that point, you really haven't turned over the vehicle fleet. You've just reached your maximum sales point. And to completely turn over the vehicle fleet would probably take another 15 or 20 years. So you're really looking at about 30, even 40 years from the time you originally introduce a technology to when you're going to get maximum benefit from it.
So I'm curious about the issue of fleet turnover, because from the statistics that we've looked at, the people are holding on to cars longer, in part because cars last longer, and in part because the economic situation encourages people to make them last longer. Do you see that kind of pattern? Is that an obstacle?
It is a definite pattern. There's 240 million vehicles on the road today. I think we're this year, I think we're going to be closer to about 13 million in new sales, but last year was around 12, so that math is easy. With 12 years, that 12 goes into 240, 20 years. So it would take about 20 years to turn that fleet over. But you are correct. The vehicles are becoming more and more reliable, and that's really a testament to the auto manufacturers. And I think the average life of a vehicle on the road today is about 18 years. That's average, so that's a pretty impressive number. And all those facts and figures, by the way, are available in our transportation data book, which you could just find by Googling that phrase, transportation data book.
And then in addition to the turnover of the fleet, there's the whole issue of the distribution system. Will we need a whole new distribution system to support new fuels that come into use?
Oh, yes, that is an issue. And it depends on the fuel and how difficult that is. Right now there are 160,000 gasoline stations, and that's just, pretty hard to compete with universal availability of a fuel. And there's about 7 million fuel-flexible vehicles on the road today out of 240 million. And so when you try and start doing this mapping of a few million vehicles, trying to find fuel among the 160 gasoline stations, consumers are just used to having universal availability. I mean, even with a fuel like diesel, it's a proven sort of market barrier that some consumers are hesitant to buy a diesel vehicle for no other reason than diesel's only available in about 15% of those 160,000 stations. So I think most would agree that diesel's pretty available, but even as available as it is, it's a bit of a market barrier.
People are hesitant to buy anything if they think they're going to have to do a little work to figure out how to get the fuel.
I think there is some of that. The good news is that, vehicles are more and more they're coming with technologies that just sort of erase that as an issue. For example, the Nissan Leaf electric vehicle has an excellent navigation system in it that tells you where the nearest charging points are. And so there's not a lot of guesswork for the owner.
So other than the distribution obstacle, what are the other critical obstacles to progress in alternative fuels for motor vehicles?
Well, I do think infrastructure is probably the key one. Cost is another, the cost of these fuels. For example, right now, natural gas cost is quite low, around $2 a gallon of gasoline equivalent. And if natural gas is to grow in use in the U.S., you really have to maintain that that cost advantage. And right now, natural gas is, as we say, it's decoupled from the cost of gasoline. Gasoline will go up and down, and right now, natural gas doesn't seem to be to move with it in tandem very much. And so if natural gas is to gain in usage, you really have to maintain that decoupling. You have to maintain a low cost.
So the nature of the vehicle technologies program seems to me such that you must be working closely with vehicle manufacturers, energy companies, and other private sector organizations. Could you tell us a little bit about those relationships, how that works?
Sure, yeah. We work very closely with both the automotive and the heavy-duty vehicle industries. I would say, first of all, that the work that we do, the vast majority of the work we do is competed, meaning there are no funds. We're primarily an R&D organization, and even with the deployment work we do, everything is solicited in competition. And so the projects that we do, we receive proposals and evaluate the best work. So even though we work closely with the auto industry and the heavy truck industry, they don't receive funds from the government to do any of this R&D or deployment work unless they compete against others and win. That said, we do have the U.S. Drive partnership, which is our light-duty partnership, and the 21st Century Truck partnership. These are two government industry partnerships, and the primary goal of these partnerships is to have government and industry work together to identify the barriers and identify the targets that are important for technologies to meet to make these to allow these technologies to compete in the marketplace. And so the partnerships tend to be mainly about information sharing and and analysis and working closely to make sure that we're all working towards the right target, the right technical targets.
I would assume that we couldn't get very far unless we'd had these partnerships with the private sector, because they're delivering the vehicles, they're designing and developing the vehicles and fuels as well. So they need to be critical players.
Yeah, it's very important because I'll give you one example. We've been working in the advanced battery world for a long time, over 20 years. And we've been working closely with the automotive industry in determining what the targets should be. What's the cost target? How many cycles do you need on a battery? How long does it have to live? What is the vibration? Everything about what it means to have a component on board an automobile is well defined in our research. And because of that relationship, we've been very successful in moving those technologies to the market. The nickel metal hydride battery technology that DOE developed in the early 90s is in virtually every hybrid on the road today. That's true whether it's a Toyota or a Honda or a Chevy. And now you see lithium ion technologies entering the market, and most of those have been partly developed by the Department of Energy. So it's been very successful, and the reason it's been successful is because from the very beginning we worked closely with the industry to help define what it was that we were developing.
Now, you mentioned early on the Clean Cities program, and I'm just curious to hear a little about that and the biofuels corridor. What are those programs about?
Sure. As I mentioned, Clean Cities has been around almost 20 years and really been advocates at the local level. We have 87 locally based coalitions, and these coalitions work at the local level to sort of address these problems that oftentimes are locally oriented, and to get alt-fuel vehicles and infrastructure into the market. So oftentimes it's dealing with fleet operators and, for instance, if you have a taxi fleet that could be converted to natural gas, you're wondering about the vehicles and about the fueling infrastructure, and the Clean Cities folks help you get that done. In addition to that, we have a couple high-profile corridors that you mentioned that have been worked on or completed over the years. And see, one in particular was this I-75 project that's going on right now. And that project is being built from about Michigan to southern Florida and includes about 30 stations, most of them with biofuels. And then there's the I-65, going from just south of Chicago all the way down to Mobile, Alabama. And we sponsored that in 2006, and it featured five Clean Cities coalitions, Central Indiana, South Shore, Indiana, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Alabama, and a couple state energy offices. And they received a little over $1 million as a Department of Energy grant to create this biofuels corridor along the whole length of that highway. And that's probably almost probably 1,500, maybe even 2,000 miles. And the corridor now features 25 E85 stations, as well as B20 biodiesel dispensers along the way, and dispensed over 5 million gallons in fuel over the last couple of years.
So these are effectively corridor approaches that focus on a particular, what you identify as two interstate highways, so that drivers using those facilities can rely on the availability of these alternative fuels throughout the corridor.
Exactly.
Interesting program. So if you kind of look beyond the borders here, do you have a sense of how the U.S. compares with other countries in terms of our progress toward the use of alternative fuels?
Yeah, that is sort of difficult to talk about because it really varies quite a bit throughout the world. I mean, for example, it's highly dependent on each country's specific situation, their resources, their state of development. But for example, Brazil is very strong in ethanol. There's strong ethanol usage because of a very large sugarcane resource. Another example would be China. China's pushing very strongly with electrification. And that makes sense because even though they're selling a lot of vehicles now, they don't really have a lot of vehicles on the road yet, and they're still building the infrastructure that it would take to support those vehicles. And so it makes sense to build a very advanced infrastructure if you can. But we in the U.S. were very strong in biofuels, very strong in advanced biofuels technologies, looking at next-generation biofuels, cellulosic biofuels, and beyond that, what they call drop-in fuels, drop-in biofuels. These are biofuels that will be really not distinguishable from existing fuels. As we talked about today, there's quite a bit of push to do more in electrification. National goals established for electrification. President Obama has a goal of 1 million electric vehicles on the road by 2015. And we're looking to do more natural gas. So here in the U.S., we are really quite strong.
So that's very impressive. And I really appreciate your spending the time for us today talking about the alternative fuels and vehicle technologies programs. From what you've said, there are some interesting challenges ahead, a lot of changes to come that were going to be important for the environment and for the economy. And we'll all be watching for those changes to happen. So thank you very much for your insights. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.